KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. Las Cruces city councilors listened to concerns surrounding the council chamber mask policy and adopted the Las Cruces Innovation and Industrial Park Master Plan this week. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
The Las Cruces City Council passed a resolution renewing the mayor's emergency proclamation and clarifying mask requirements within council chambers, despite resistance from some members of the public. Mayor Ken Miyagashima addressed residents concerned about a requirement mandating those without a COVID-19 vaccine wear a mask in council chambers.
Nowhere did we expect you to be vaccinated. You know, we just say, hey, if you're not vaccinated or you're not willing to show us, then just wear a mask. I think it's incumbent on me or the council to make sure that this council chambers is as free as possible from COVID, from the variant.
Las Cruces resident Tracy Hollister spoke out against the resolution, saying an emergency proclamation isn't necessary.
So I want to say that when you find out someone's unvaccinated, you cannot make the assumption that they are unsafe and they are dangerous, nor should you require them to do anything else.
While proof of vaccination is currently required to enter the chambers without a mask, some unvaccinated residents were able to attend the city council meeting maskless, something Councilor Tessa Beda-Stuvey warned others about.
I was also notified that there are people in the room that are unvaccinated as well. And so if people are at risk, high risk, or have those that they love, that should please take the appropriate cautions as you see fit.
The emergency proclamation, extended only by 3 days with the passing of this resolution, is now set to expire on July 23rd, 2021, the same date the governor's executive order declaring a state of public health emergency expires. The city council also unanimously adopted the Las Cruces Innovation and Industrial Park Master Plan, establishing strategic goals with the hopes of improving the image and visibility of the park. City Manager Ifo Pili says his goal is to attract more businesses to the area.
The next step is not to bring forward a plan for infrastructure for me. I don't plan to fund that with city dollars at this time. That's not what I'm going to propose. The plan is to take that plan that's been created and go out and get businesses. One, it's too expensive to do that. Whatever funding mechanism we come forward, I don't want to spend money to do that because businesses, once we get the businesses attracted, they'll spend money. They'll build the infrastructure they need. They have everything they need right now. And I think I want to drive in that point publicly. They have the infrastructure in place.
Currently, 19 businesses occupy space in the industrial park, taking up 340 of the park's 1,820 acres. Urban planner William Gleason says the demand for industrial space in New Mexico is high.
Nationally and statewide, the trend for the demand for industrial and warehouse space is like it has not been in decades. You have this confluence of the demand for additional space due to onshoring, due to the demand for data centers, the demand for logistics, and also the spaceport. You're at a great location on the border that really can take advantage of some national and regional trends and create more jobs here in Las Cruces.
Detailed specifics on the plan, specifically regarding the regulatory framework, are expected to be given to the council in August. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
A group of abortion providers in Texas have filed a federal lawsuit challenging a state ban on abortions as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports abortion rights advocates say if the law goes into effect, it will essentially eliminate access to abortion in Texas.
Earlier this year, state lawmakers passed Senate Bill 8, which prohibits Texans from getting an abortion once a fetal heartbeat is detected. Experts say that could be as early as 6 weeks, which is before many women even know they are pregnant. Instead of the state enforcing the law, SB 8 allows any private citizen, including people outside of Texas, to sue anyone who helps a woman get an abortion. Amy Hagstrom-Miller, the president and CEO of Whole Women's Health, says the law will bury clinics in lawsuits and more harassment. And she says the law has already started worrying patients.
The ultrasonographer that I spent yesterday with was telling me that already she said 80% of the patients she's been serving in the last month have been asking, while they're in the clinic on the day of their abortion, if it's legal.
Plaintiffs in the case are suing every state court trial judge and county clerk in Texas, various medical boards, as well as the attorney general. They are asking the court to block the law before it goes into effect September 1st. I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
Two survivors of Japanese-American internment camps are calling on the Biden administration to shut down its emergency shelters for migrant children and teens. KERA's Mallory Falk talked with them at an El Paso rally.
Nikki Nojima Lewis spent part of her childhood in an internment camp in Idaho. Her father was detained hundreds of miles away at another camp in New Mexico.
When I was younger, I used to say, well, I'm the last generation alive that have this experience. But now I think I'm just on a continuum.
Lewis attended a rally outside the Fort Bliss Army base. A tent facility there is the largest of more than a dozen emergency intake sites the Biden administration set up last spring, when a record number of migrant children and teens crossed the border on their own. The goal was to move them out of Border Patrol facilities more quickly and provide somewhere else to stay while they waited to join family or sponsors. The government has already shut down or announced plans to close many of those sites, but is keeping this one open for now, despite reports of unsafe and unsanitary conditions. Organizers are calling on the government to close down the Fort Bliss site and others like it, and instead house children in state-licensed facilities, which have higher standards for care. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
Faith leaders and immigration advocates across the country recently advocated in Washington, D.C. for a pathway to citizenship for essential workers. Some even took part in a solidarity fast to bring attention to the issue. Anthony Moreno recently spoke with some advocates from New Mexico who made the trip to D.C. Irvin Villa is a dreamer and essential worker from Anthony, New Mexico. Nina Benavidez, a community organizer from Silver City with NM Cafe, a faith-based community organizing group, and Stevie Paz, a digital organizer with that group. All three shared why they say Congress needs to act and provide a path to citizenship for essential workers.
Irvin, I'd like to start with you. You actually took part in this fast. You're a dreamer. What was it that inspired you to take part in this effort? Why is it so important to you?
For me, this was important because my purpose of going to Washington to fast was to advocate for essential workers and dreamers. But in my spirit, I also took as an advocating for all 11 million undocumented Americans who live here. This experience was amazing, but it was hard because it was a whole new experience for me that I've never, ever got to try before. But the purpose was for me to represent my community, community and dreamers and community for mixed family status here.
Nina, now the House already this year has passed some measures to make a pathway to citizenship for dreamers, for farm workers. We've seen some movement there. Now there's also been some Republicans that have voted with them to pass this. I mean, what are your hopes for this effort to actually happen sometime soon? Because it's something that's been talked about for a long time. There's been a lot of organizing around it. There's been many marches. There's been many issues surrounding this, many folks affected. We've seen what the DACA program has gone through over the last 9 years. From your perspective as an organizer on the ground talking with people, you know, how do you feel this is going to be addressed this summer? Do you think it's going to happen soon?
I think that this is the perfect opportunity for it to happen. There are a couple of ways that this can happen, but we are hoping that this can work through the budgetary reconciliation process, which would take it out of the filibuster process. And so that we at least have a pathway to citizenship for essential workers and ideally for all 11 million undocumented workers. The Fast for Freedom, one of the things I want to really say about it was one of the slogans was the hunger for justice. And so with that in mind, the fast was not just about the fast for a physical fast, but the fast of the idea that we need to hunger for justice for our undocumented brothers and sisters.
With this issue, Stevie, when we think about the pandemic, when we think about all the people that have been affected, how have those who are undocumented, who may be essential workers, how have they been affected in our region?
I think specifically for our region, I mean, first and foremost, right, when it came to stimulus checks that people received, right, many of those people got left out simply because they're undocumented and they don't have access to that. And if they do, it's because, you know, some of their family members are mixed status, right? Some might have citizenship, some might have not. And I would also say that farm workers, right, they still continue during the pandemic. And I think when it came to information, right, the simplest thing is, like, you know, wearing a mask, washing your hands, that were pretty repetitive to maybe the rest of us that have access to, you know, computers, cell phone, internet. Some of them weren't getting that information. And so I think a lot, especially when I'm talking specifically for New Mexico, a lot of immigrant rights groups had to, you know, create that information for them to receive it. And, you know, I think they suffered a lot because, you know, they didn't have the luxury to stop working, just as, you know, frontline workers who work in a restaurant or essential business. So I think they suffered a lot.
I want to thank you all for joining us, Nena Benavides, Irvin Villa, and Stevie Paz.
Thank you.
The StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative visited Las Cruces in March of last year, and through this month, we are presenting portions of those interviews. Today, Katrina Graham interviews her mother, Jacqueline Williams, about her father, Gary Williams, an Army pilot in the Vietnam War.
Dad passed away a year and a half ago or so. I've done a lot of thinking about the things I knew about Dad and the things I didn't know about Dad. And one of the biggest things that I didn't know about Dad was about his earlier life when, you know, all of the things that happened before me, because, you know, we were the most important thing. So, but all of that came before us. And one of those was how you guys met and married and Vietnam.
Well, you know, there was a huge cultural change when I first started toward college, which was 1968. So there was a lot of things going on when I left for college in 1968, a lot of flower children, a lot of civil unrest, et cetera. And Gary had a sort of rocky adolescence because his family had a lot of financial challenges. And he ended up in a Naval Reserve unit and went to the Tonkin Bay. When he returned home, something went awry, and he apparently was notified that his reserve unit was being changed, and he was supposed to have reported to a different reserve unit, but he didn't get the letter from his mother, so he ended up drafted into the Army around age 20, did basic training, and eventually he was offered the option of either going to Vietnam as an infantry enlisted person or going to flight school.
And I remember him saying he decided he'd go to flight school because that kept him out of the war longer.
Another year before he would have to go to the war. So he went to helicopter flight school at Fort Walters, and it turned out he was a natural pilot. He enjoyed being a pilot beyond anything he had ever done. So he went for his first tour in Vietnam around 1966 or 1967, because I know he flew in the Tet Offensive. He's described that before, and that was a very heavy battle period. He flew thousands of hours. They were in very heavy combat. He flew gunships. I heard him refer to these as old B models. They would run out of ammunition, and the door gunners would carry bags of rocks to throw. He eventually was shot down enough times that he had a really bad crash, ended up with some crushed bones in his face, some burns and things, and he was medevaced to Japan. He had everything repaired, and then he resumed active duty going to Fort Walters, Texas, as a TAC officer at the helicopter school, and that's where I met him. I met him at a party. They would organize groups of women from various colleges to go for fun. They were very dressed up parties. They would have these balls. And so I had gone to a party where one of his students actually had asked me to come through a friend because his lieutenant didn't have a date for the
party. Was Dad the lieutenant?
He was the lieutenant, yes. So he was the first lieutenant when I met him.
So how much time did you and Dad spend together before you decided to get married, or was this, were you dating over the phone?
Well, we dated that fall and on weekends several times, mm-hmm. maybe 10 dates, 12 dates, before he was transferred to Georgia. Then the rest of it was on the phone.
I can't imagine Dad having that much to say.
Oh my goodness, he would keep me on the phone for hours and hours. You know, they say the part of your brain that falls in love is the same part that develops obsessive compulsive disorder. So
it must have been, because Dad was never much of a phone guy.
Well, he was in those days.
And what did you talk about?
I don't even recall. I don't think it was important.
I
think it was just being together on the phone.
How did Granddaddy react when you said you wanted to get married?
Oh, my father was always horrified if we became interested in any male of the species. And he was particularly horrified because this was a soldier going back over to Vietnam. I was so busy that I didn't fret a lot, but my dad got an ulcer. And he tracked all of that horrible news from Vietnam, the body counts and the, you know, all of those things. He had to be treated for an ulcer during that time that Gary was gone to Vietnam, because he did have time to worry about it. So he did worry a lot about it.
Did Dad ever talk about that first crash, or the big crash that brought him home from his first tour? Did he talk about how that happened, where he was, how long
it took? Well, they got shot down. Mm-hmm. He did talk about that crash. That crash had an unusual experience with it, in that they hit the ground very hard and their aircraft caught fire. And he recalls standing outside the aircraft, someone was standing beside him, and he could see himself and the whole crew inside the aircraft. The person that said to him said, "You have a choice now. You can go or stay." And he was horrified. He's like, "I have to get the people out of that helicopter." So then he found himself back in his seat. He was able to get out his tool that cuts the seatbelt, and they were able to get everyone out of the aircraft. Everyone lived through that crash. But he recalls having the opportunity, possibly, to not stay on Earth.
To hear this segment and all of our StoryCorps segments, you can check out our StoryCorps page in the radio section at krwg.org. Funding for this segment provided by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for their residents. Accepting admission in their 3 sanitized homes. More information at 575-525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. So great to be with you on this Saturday. The fight continues against plans to locate nuclear waste dumps in the region. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham and the New Mexico congressional delegation, with the exception of Representative Yvette Harrell, sent a letter to Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm opposing plans for a nuclear waste site near Carlsbad. There's also opposition to another site in West Texas. Andrews County commissioners recently voted to write a resolution opposing a plan to bring highly radioactive nuclear waste to their community. It's a big turnaround for Andrews County, where officials previously supported a local waste company's application for a federal license to ship in what's called high-level waste from nuclear plants across the country. Tommy Taylor is with Protect the Basin. The opposition group represents oil companies and ranchers who say a nuclear waste accident could devastate their industries.
I think it's important that Andrews has stood up and said, "Hey, we weren't really fully aware of this, and we are absolutely against it."
It's up to federal regulators to decide whether the plan can move forward. That decision is expected in September. In a statement, the company behind the plan, Waste Control Specialists, says it stands by its safety record and is proud of the, quote, essential work it does for the state. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has no plans to issue a statewide mask mandate for schools, even though children under 12 are not yet eligible for COVID-19 vaccines and cases are on the rise. He told Fox that masking up is up to parents.
This is an issue of parental choice and will not be an issue of mandates.
Governor Abbott issued an executive order earlier this year prohibiting public schools from requiring face masks. This week, the American Academy of Pediatrics released updated guidance for COVID-19 protocols in schools. The group recommends staff and all students over the age of 2 wear masks, whether or not they're vaccinated. The federal government says teachers and students who are fully vaccinated against the coronavirus don't have to wear masks indoors. But that guidance, published by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, also recommends students and staff stay at least 3 feet apart to reduce the spread of a disease that is primarily transmitted through the air. Elsewhere in the U.S., schools and state officials have adopted a patchwork of rules for students and teachers. Some states, including Rhode Island, have done away with mask mandates for schools. Others are leaving the decision to districts. Illinois health officials say they are fully adopting the CDC guidelines. In California, state officials say that they are worried that imposing social distancing would make it harder for some schools to accommodate all students who return to classrooms. So they made a choice. California will not require physical distancing in exchange for everyone wearing a mask. My guest today is dealing with these issues too. Ralph Ramos is the new superintendent in Las Cruces Public Schools. Superintendent Ramos, thank you for being here today. And I want to begin with this topic as we record this. As you know, New Mexico has yet to announce its own guidance. But what do you think should be done in regard to precautions as we get ready to go back to school?
Thank you so much, Mr. Martino, for having me here. To answer your question, I think I know that Las Cruces Public Schools has been complying with our New Mexico Public Education Department recommendations. We call it the toolkit, and that's the big thing that with the Bible that we follow, you know, to make sure that we comply with the Department of Health as well as the New Mexico PED department are looking at the CDC guidelines and trying to adjust, you know, accordingly to what our needs are in our state. And that's what we've been following all along. And, the thing that's made it really challenging has been, the toolkit changing periodically as we've lived and rode and weathered this storm of COVID. And currently right now, we still are in place. If you're not vaccinated, you have to wear a mask, and that goes along for all students, staff members. If we're going to be around students and if there's a summer program that's happening, we have to wear a mask as well anytime we're around students. Whether we're vaccinated as adults or not, that's what we have to do. On the other hand, athletics, is a big thing as well, and that's been very controversial because the New Mexico Athletic Association is allowing students not to wear a mask if they are vaccinated as well. On the other hand, the students that are not vaccinated have to wear that mask, and outside in these warm, hot summer days and, being competitive, it makes it pretty difficult, not only for athletics, but even for PE programs that we have going on in our district. Has made it challenging, and we're just really chomping at the bit to get the new toolkit to hopefully see some changes that correlate with the CDC guidelines, which at the national level, not all students have to wear masks. So it's a little difficult, although on the other hand, Las Cruces Public Schools, we are rule followers. In fact, we've kind of set the leadership on that. And, as superintendent, I need to make sure that we all comply and do the very best we can, being that we care about kids and our employees, and we want a safe learning environment, whether we're inside or outside.
Yeah. Now, of course, the COVID vaccination is available for those who are 12 or older. What about those who say require vaccination? This would make it easier for high schools where everyone's 12 and up, and perhaps most, if not all, middle schools as well.
Right. You know, and requiring everyone to get vaccinated, you know, we require students to get vaccinated for other, you know, things as well. But on the other hand, there's ways to opt out for different medical reasons and those type of things. I know one of the challenges even up in the governor's office is, and I've only heard, you know, rumors that there's a form, you know, that we're going to have to be filling out. And you hear all these rumors that are floating out there, you know, because, you know, that's part of HIPAA violations and, you know, really impeaching on privacy of where you stand on vaccinations and who's vaccinated or not. But on the other hand, we're just kind of waiting for that toolkit to come out so we can comply. And maybe it might change, it may not.
Well, of course, as you know, New Mexico has already said that they will not require students to be vaccinated to go back to in-person learning. Of course, though, some colleges and universities have done this. They have said if you want to have in-person learning and you want to live on campus, you're going to have to get vaccinated. New Mexico State and the University of New Mexico have not done this, but there have been schools, as you know, all over the country that have. What do you think about that?
You know, and I have to respect their campus, you know, and a lot of them, you know, they charge tuition. You know, we are a free, appropriate public education, you know, and we have to comply with our, you know, public of education department and those regulations. So that's what makes us different from others, you know, making those decisions. Now, on the other hand, there's probably districts even in New Mexico that are not complying with that. But you know what? I'm not going to put ourselves in that liability, you know, especially knowing that even the data always drives need and the need drives change. And right now the data is, you know, from day to day, our numbers are still looking good, but then there's little days where, you know, they increase and there's still pockets of COVID here in Doñana County. So, you know, in one sense, you know, half of me is like, let's not use masks at all. On the other hand, gosh, what if one of our employees or one of our students does, you know, pick up COVID from our lack of safety measures, and if we didn't comply, then I would really have a hard time living with that. And so to me, you know, I have to balance that out and do what's best for kids, given the rules that we have to follow.
All right. Well, a question I know that you are getting, and you'll probably be getting a lot, when will playgrounds be open to the public again?
Excellent question. And, you know, when you start getting into playgrounds and campuses, especially when majority of our campuses are empty during the summer, you know, it's about monitoring the, you know, who's there during the day. Unfortunately, you know, some vandalism sometimes takes place, or there's people using our facilities that don't necessarily follow rules of, you know, things like that are out there, that we're trying to just make it a safe learning environment. We do have two campuses, one Oronata Elementary, as well as East Picacho, who are open to the public, you know, pretty on weekends as well as throughout the week. Actually, all campuses are open throughout the regular school day during the week. But on weekends, these two schools are open as a pilot to see what we're going to do. But I'm hoping that after July 30th, everything will be open back to normal with our playgrounds and campuses as well.
Okay. Another specific question for you, and you kind of indicated this fear in one of your answers. Even with precautions, we know that there will be some families who will still be very concerned about the COVID situation. So will remote learning still be an option for families?
Absolutely. Super question. And, you know, one of the things I got to really commend Las Cruces Public Schools has been that we've always had a virtual learning academy in our district. And we've always tried to look at opportunities for kids, even at accelerated levels or medical reasons or whatever. We look at each individual student you know, for their needs, their niche. What can we do to help them with their situation? And right now we have given students in our district, all students, a choice either to come in person, like we started this past semester, or to attend our virtual learning academy. And that's definitely still an option. And I know as data changes, as COVID changes, hopefully it gets behind us rather than again in front of us with all these new variants and all those type of things. But parents and families will continue to have those choices. I will assure you that. What makes it difficult on my end is to balance, you know, your in-person teachers to meet the needs of kids that are attending. And let's say we lose an influx of 50 or 60 students to VLA the last minute, we're going to have to make some adjustments. But I will tell you one thing, we've been planning ahead of this. We're looking at our preliminary data of 1,100 students that were going to be attending VLA. So we made the adjustments for 30 teachers, 30 additional teachers to support that program. On the other hand, it was hard for my leadership team for us to cut the regular campuses where in-person is going to take place. So we're really waiting on numbers, but we're ready however it comes. We're now looking at some new data that has changed, that we're looking at about 300 VLA students, and that's K through 12. So, you know, things can change. We're ready for it. We're well prepared for it, and trying to meet that challenge. Yes, sir.
Yeah. So as you know, many students have really struggled with remote learning. What are some key takeaways for you as an educator when you're having to do this?
You know, key takeaways, you know, and a lot of people talk about gaps in education and how much we've lost, learning losses there, you know, not only for students, but also for teachers, you know. But I got to be honest with you. Yes, you know, and we're going to be doing some initial assessments when students return back, you know, this coming fall. But it's not only about that. What have students gained? What have teachers gained? Our practice is so incredible. I mean, stop and think about this interview right now. We're doing it via Zoom. We've changed our style. We've learned new ways, and you know, and learning and growing every day. And that's what COVID did to us. We've learned how to engage kids at a total level that we, you know, we never have done before. You know, talk about technology and the awareness. What a celebration, Doñana County, Las Cruces, New Mexico, to know that every one of our students has access to a computer, one-to-one. You know, not only that, but also service of Wi-Fi connection, you know, whether we had to provide hotspots or, you know, do somersaults, whatever we had to do for every kid, you know, in our district to have those equal opportunities for all of them to learn, but also not only to learn, but to engage in discussions with the creativity that teachers really brought to the table. They are so resilient, and I know they were exhausted by the end of the day, you know, the end of the school year, but let me tell you, I know they're rested up. They're gonna be coming back really more vibrant than ever. And I know that Las Cruces is gonna do some great things for kids, and we're gonna do things a little bit differently because we've learned a lot through this COVID pandemic.
Well, I'm glad you know, framed it that way, because as someone who teaches college classes, I know that these young people in high school, it will be, they may not feel good about remote learning right now, but they will when they get to college, because they're going to have to use technology. And even for in-person college classes, they're going to have an online element of some kind. So they'll be used to it. And then just to kind of follow up on what you said in your answer, so the Las Cruces District was able, you're saying, to provide internet and provide a device for any student that didn't already have that.
That is correct. And we do continuous assessments. You know, one of the unique things that Las Cruces Public Schools did, and it's easy for principals, you know, just coming out of Camino Real Middle School, you know, we try to do the very best, you know, to provide this technology, but we really dug in deep. What devices do we have here to distribute now in the moment of crisis to make sure every kid had a computer? And then when we dispersed all our equipment, then we found the total number of how many additional devices do we have. And that's where our technology support and the planning there, you know, had computers coming in and we started distributing them. Not only that, now is that we need to really be thankful for the federal dollars that came in. I think what a great time for New Mexico legislation to really, you know, get involved now to really provide us the sustainability down the road, not these next 3 years. We have federal funds to really provide, and really it's been needed for a long time. And it's unfortunate that this pandemic had to take place in order to get all students and staff on a one-to-one device for technology type of learning. But to me, New Mexico is going to be challenged down the road 3 years from now, as technology tends to be obsolete at least every 3 to 4 years and getting new updated devices. How are we going to continue doing this for kids? You know, they keep saying New Mexico is ranked at the very bottom, you know, in our country. But now is the time. And I ask our leaders to really step up and join us, embrace, you know, our ideas to really make this happen, to do what's best for kids, because we have the teacher power, the teacher brain power and creativity to really do the right things for student learning. And I think it's just providing them with the right tools and all the right systems to make sure that we move up and be competitive at the national level.
Sure.
Because I know.
Let's talk about those tools. Besides technology, in your view, what are some other major things that are needed to ensure equity in our schools?
Well, curriculum. You know, I think curriculum needs to, you know, and it, I think New Mexico has a great system already in place where we vet it out. We have textbook adoption programs that go on, and we circulate that. I don't think that there's, I know in Las Cruces Public Schools, we don't lack textbooks or curriculum or things like that. To me, it's about having our standards aligned and our teachers being allowed to get creative to teach towards those standards and to really teach what's right and effective. You know, the days of starting in chapter one and ending in chapter 36 are really, those are over, they're behind us. Now it's about creative learning and how to make sure that we get the concept. I strongly believe that, you know, even like a typical math class anymore, you know, you and I probably were given 30, 40 math problems with homework and all of that. Why are we doing that? To me, give the kid five, you know, problems, if they master them, gosh, move them on to a new concept and let's keep building on their skill and looking at, you know, their proficiency skills with that to teach what we really need to teach rather than a lot of filler stuff. And to me, that's what's making it exciting, is new ways to teach, providing teachers with different tools to make them successful, to be able to engage kids in the classroom, plus making it exciting for them as well.
And of course, our viewers are familiar with one of the tools, which is giving students a chance to have an internship in their senior year. We had a young man on this program recently who had an internship at KRWG and actually produced a documentary during that internship. So that's a great thing. Another issue I want to move on to in terms of equity is a concern in terms of our textbooks and our lessons in our schools. As you know, recently at a Las Cruces school board meeting, there was quite a bit of pushback by some audience members over how Las Cruces Public Schools was working to ensure equity. What do you make of this controversy, which of course, by the way, is a national controversy? It's not just in Las Cruces, but we've seen this at school board meetings all over the country.
And that's a difficult question, sir, but let me tell you that one of the things that I participated in about a year and a half ago, right prior to COVID, was the cultural and linguistic orientation that they gave us, which I think a lot of people have misinterpreted. They're thinking it's a curriculum, no different than what I talked about a while ago, starting in chapter one, ending in chapter 36, and here we are learning every piece in that guide. This is actually a guide that's been given to principals. Some teachers have started learning and engaging and educating themselves about this guide that was provided to us. And it's all started with the Yazzie Martinez case that took place, and equitable opportunities for all students. And I gotta be honest with you, there's some really good activities in that guide that really what we're trying to do is to pretty much educate teachers that there are multiple ways to educate students, and they all come in red, white, and blue colors. And we need to respect them all and just level the playing field with them. And one of the things, and it kind of goes into my Mexican culture that I have, a lot of times it's hard when a teacher's talking to you, or anyone for that matter, for students to look at you directly into the eyes. And a lot of times students will just look down and talk, yes sir, no sir, still very polite, but a lot of times there might be a teacher that they find that offensive, but they don't understand the culture that comes out. So I think it's just little things like that to make a better knowledge, to respect every kid, whoever they are. One of the cool activities that we did at my school at Camino Real, when I went through this, we came back and every individual student during their advisory time got to research their own last name and where they came from, to be proud of whether you're Smith or Ramos or whatever your last name is and your culture, and to be able to share things that you do in your family to celebrate. And it's unfortunate that there are some students that do tend to bully, okay? And that's going to be one of my goals this year, is that we commit every student, every adult, whether you're a parent, a teacher, a custodian, principal, to commit to no bullying, no violence, and no drugs. And with that comes three expectations. Don't participate, walk away, and tell an adult. And to me, really, if we all come together with that, because even right when COVID was coming out, I had to deal with some racial comments, even as meaningful as calling students COVID, some of our Asian students, and that's just not going to be acceptable.
And Superintendent, I think if people listen to your answer there, they'll get a better understanding of what your district and what many other districts around the country are trying to do. And it's basic good education, respect for others. But as you know, this has really become a political issue. Critics say that some politicians are using race as a political weapon, trying to rile up their base of voters, and that's driving some of this. What do you make of that?
Yes, sir. And I won't argue with that. I think that is, and it's unfortunate, because I think there's going to be a lot of good things that comes from this before it's all over. I think just number one is having respect for everyone, no matter who you are. And I think that's been pretty common, Las Cruces is a very diverse community that we live in, and a lot of great people.
And great teachers, by the way, too. And that brings me to another question that I think is really important.
Yes,
and I'd like you to answer it. We have seen some states, including Texas now, place restrictions on teachers who instruct students about race and other issues. Your thoughts about politicians getting involved in this way, actually passing legislation to restrict educators in the classroom?
I don't like to restrict teachers. I just think that if we are gonna bring up a topic, it needs to be vetted out on both sides of the fence. Mm-hmm. But really, to be honest with you, to me, it's about the students facilitating those type of debates or discussions, you know, and really they're the ones that engage in that. And it's where the teacher has to be neutral on and see both sides. And it tends to be difficult. But I got to be honest with you, it's not like we're going to be, that's going to be part of our curriculum where we're going to have those type of things. It's no different than like current issues, you know, in an advisory class, you know, when current issues happen, whether it's weather, whether it's politics, whether it's, you know, whatever topic that's out there that's coming out with current issues, you know, teachers do engage in those and provide opportunities for students to take off and really learn from all the things that are going on in our world.
And as a longtime educator, you know this well, and I can remember back to being in middle school and high school. Some of the best teachers I had really integrated that into the classroom to integrate current events, what's happening now, to help students really engage and understand the importance of what they were learning, that it applied to real life.
It does apply to real life. And a lot of times what happens is that, you know, really teachers aren't the ones that always bring these topics up, okay? What happens is sometimes there's, you know, catastrophic events that happen and the kids are, that's where their brain's at. You know, that's anything.
After all, we just had an attack on our very own U.S. Capitol. And so students have, I can't imagine the questions in the classroom. And so it's so important that teachers and administrators such as yourself don't feel like by educating students that they're going to ever be in the political crosshairs, because that could really hurt education. Believe it or not, we're out of time, and I appreciate you joining us for a half hour today to kind of talk about some of these really important issues, and we wish you well in the year ahead as you start your first full school year as superintendent in Las Cruces Public Schools.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for having me here, and you know, we're looking forward to a great year. God bless everybody, and we're looking forward to some great things this year. Thank you so much.
And if you joined us midway through, you can watch that entire interview tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV. KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. Great to be with you. Homebound seniors who are not tech savvy can be difficult to reach with information about the COVID-19 vaccine. But there could be a solution. Here's Roz Brown from the Texas News Service.
Your Shot Texas is set to give additional nonprofit community-based organizations money for programs that increase access to COVID-19 vaccines. The statewide philanthropic effort already has invested more than $400,000 in 12 organizations to battle hesitancy and make sure communities hit hardest can get vaccinated. Lisa Reeve directs a voluntary association of local governments in Texarkana. Her group used grant money to create a brochure and hire an outreach worker to contact unvaccinated populations, especially older folks who were homebound.
None of the seniors knew how to navigate a computer and set up an appointment, and we've got that on our brochure, letting them know that we'll be able to assist anybody that needs help.
Reeve says her group is mostly helping seniors in their 9-county area, but can help anyone who still needs a shot. Local organizations that want to initiate their own program have until August 6 to apply for funds through Your Shot Texas. In recent days, the Delta variant has pushed the COVID-19 positivity rate to 10% in Texas, compared with less than 3% a month ago. In addition to seniors and those living in rural areas, Brian Sasser with the Episcopal Health Foundation says grants prioritize the Black, Hispanic, Latino, and other populations most affected during the pandemic. He adds that groups receiving the money have a deep connection to their community.
So they know the people who they work with, they know their needs, what's holding people back from getting vaccines. So those are the best people to kind of convince those on the fence.
In addition to the Episcopal Health Foundation, San Antonio's Methodist Healthcare Ministries of South Texas, Inc., and the Meadows Foundation in Dallas have pooled funds to fill the gap and support outreach efforts and activities that may not qualify for public resources. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
We end the show with commentary this week and a really important issue. Some are raising alarm about the influence of scam artists on our politics in the United States, including commentator Walt Rubel.
A few years ago, I was scammed by callers claiming to offer a great deal on my satellite TV service. I felt bad about losing the money, but felt worse about being duped. We all like to think we're too savvy to be taken in, and it stings the pride to admit it when we're not. A few months ago, an HBO documentary exposed Ronald Watkins, a 30-something porn-addled techie living in Asia, as Q, the secretive mastermind behind the QAnon phenomenon. Q was supposed to be somebody in the highest reaches of the federal government, with access to all the top secret classified documents. Former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn was once thought to be a possible candidate. Q spoke to his followers through Q drops, cryptic predictions that were spread on the internet platform that Watkins managed from overseas. The prophecies of Donald Trump's return to power following his election loss have gone unfulfilled, despite the efforts of the movement's most impassioned followers at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. And now, even some of QAnon's most ardent believers are having to wrestle with the possibility that maybe Tom Hanks doesn't murder children so he can drink their blood in an effort to increase his sexual prowess. QAnon followers have been duped, and the whole country knows it. And so, where do those who swallowed the fishtail, hook, line, and sinker go from here? Are they relieved to learn that the butchered children they've anguished over these past several months never existed? Probably not. For most, pride won't allow that. Last month, the FBI issued a report on QAnon at the request of U.S. Senator Martin Heinrich of New Mexico. The report warns that even though the last Q drop fell more than 6 months ago, the threat posed by QAnon followers still remains. The report warns that some followers will grow impatient waiting for further instructions and will take action on their own. Watkins may not be some top secret government agent, but he's no dummy. He exploited the emotions that all of us feel when we hear real stories about abused children. More than that, he exposed the bitter hatred that far too many Americans have towards those with different political views. The fact that so many of us were willing to believe the most horrific allegations imaginable about political rivals probably tells us more about where we're at as a nation as it tells us about them. It's easy to blame the internet. How else could somebody like Ronald Watkins have such an enormously harmful impact on our country? But blaming the internet is a little bit like shooting the messenger. We all need to change the message of our political debate. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. So great to be with you. If you ever miss the program, don't worry. We have you covered. It is always available online in the local radio section at krwg.org. Stay with us at the region's homepage all weekend long for the latest news. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces and KRXG. Silver City. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.